So this is the second discourse, talk on the Bahiya Sutta. And as I was mentioning, the Bahiya Sutta is a very raw sutta. It's like, okay, clear away the stuff, Buddha. Just give it to me, because I'm. And it's you know, often I think the Buddha spoke in relationship to the urgency of the questioner and to the sincerity of the questioner. And so this questioner was obviously very sincere, and also obviously just had a little dust in his eyes, so to speak, metaphorically. And so he says, let me hear the message, the essence of the message. And so the Buddha says, in the seeing there's only what is seen. In the hearing there is only what is heard. And he goes through all the senses. So how do we make this sutta relevant and practical? How do we make this language that seems so remote? Well, that's nice, but what does that have to do with my life? How do we make this pragmatic? I had a whole talk prepared. And I got back from Cloud Mountain this afternoon. Over the weekend, I was teaching a retreat at Cloud Mountain. Some of you were on. And I read over what I asked. I said, that's a nice canned talk. But it seems like the sutta is asking something more from the speaker than a performance of his ignorance. Candid. And that's okay. I just left it behind. And I grabbed something else. Because I need something. And so I just thought I'd come in and we'll just talk about the sutta. And I'd like to talk about it in relationship to the dyad of last week. Those of you who exchanged in that very profound way, for some of you. And the dyad, for those who weren't involved, were two people sitting across from one another asking a repetitive question. What are you bringing to this moment? Was the first question, and that was said for 5 minutes. And then the follow-up question that each person said to the other for 5 minutes was, who would you be if you brought nothing to this? And we also did that on the retreat. And what some of you understood was happening was that you progressively were getting closer to the seeing in the seeing as just what was seen. Because what was being revealed in each moment's question and response was another layer of the onion that was being peeled back of what we are bringing to the moment, so that the moment has no newness. It's always covered with age. The age of our thought, the age of our expectation, the age of our anticipation, the age of our memory, the age of our anxiety. The history of moments where I've been with somebody and not had something correct to say and how that felt. So who are you? Who am I when I bring nothing to the moment? And that's not a game, an intellectual game in which we try to outsmart the questioner. That's not a call for intelligence to speak. That's a call for the rawness of the human heart to meet the question and to see that whatever I or you answer is just an experience that we've overlaid upon this moment to make it something. To make it acceptable, to make it presentable, or not, because it's not so important to the sense of me, to the egoic sense of me, whether I make it an approving moment or a disapproving moment, a pleasant moment or an unpleasant moment, because either way, the moment is defined, and that's what's important, is for the mind to place a definition upon it. Even a suffering definition is better than no definition at all. And as we were working through that same dyad on the retreat, there were a number of very new students there. So I think perhaps the question wasn't as well received by new people. And one woman said, well, she was glad she did it, but she was so frightened the entire time that she didn't think she'd ever do it again. But she didn't see, you see, that, so this is a very, she didn't see that the fear was what was allowing her to define the moment and her relationship to it. And that's what she was bringing to the moment. That was the answer to the question. That was the experience that was being unveiled as the question was being spoken. And so there's always, for most of us, some part of ourselves that we hold in abeyance, that we hold behind, that we really believe in, that we think that this is the kernel, the essence of the truth of this situation. And we'll talk about other things that come up in our mind in casual sense. Yeah, I'm feeling this, or yeah, I'm feeling that. But behind the scene is the anxiety or the base root feeling that we think really contains me, the me-ness. This is really me. And we're so identified with that 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 is not seen as another covering of the moment. Now, I think we begin to perceive the value of true questioning, because the question comes from, if it's done correctly, and it can come from anything, it can come from the mind, which is just an intellectual ploy to be clever, or it can come from the rawness of the heart that really wants to uncover itself and know true connection. Because every time we put something onto the moment, that something shields our heart from its true radiance. You know, at the end of the retreat, I said to the people, you're very different Monday morning, this morning, than you were Friday evening or Saturday. We came full of our content, full of the messages of our mind, full of our abstract entanglements, full of our agendas. And slowly, over the course of those few days, which is not different than the course of 45-minute sitting, when we sit down on the cushion, we're full of the reasons why we shouldn't sit, why we have other better things to do, which often intrude on us sitting at all. But if we can actually make it to the cushion, then the question of what we're bringing to the moment becomes obvious. In the sitting, it's just layer after layer of stuff. The mind just fires endlessly at point blank range. It's covering of the moment. Like a magician. And then something very refined begins to happen. In some sittings. The content, the pressure of the words, become lighter and not as impersonally. It's not suddenly there's an impersonalization to the processes that are going on, that somehow the voice of the personal becomes quieter. And perhaps by the end of the sitting, if it's a relatively quiet sitting, there is this sense of peace and quiet, as over the course of several days on a retreat, there's also a growing sense of contentment. And so I asked the people on this retreat, why are you different now than you were on Friday night? Why are you different at the end of your sitting than you were at the beginning? It's because the content became less important. And from that, there was more engagement of heart, more connection of heart. The seeing was about what was seen, rather than about my interpretations of what was seen. My hearing is about what is heard, not my dialoguing and reactivity about what is heard. And so, the less coverage we place upon the moment, the more the heart speaks. The more the heart engages. And the mind, as in many of these new students, gets very frightful about that because it's not as defined. People who are at the end of the retreat, or even at the end of your sitting, you're not as defined as you were when you sat down. Because the content is in abeyance, because the content was what was forming the definition. You know yourself because you know me, or that, or this. That those two arise together. And if we release ourselves from knowing something in its exact detail, meaning its content, meaning its logic, its thought, abstract concept, then I too am less well defined. And we would never go there except for one thing. The heart loves it. That's why we go there. Because you can see the faces of the people at the end of the retreat, and perhaps you at the end of a sitting. Serenity. a contentment in which they aren't being pushed to move, aren't being compelled to move. It's as if the world has loosened its hold, but not its effect upon us. We're still deeply affected by it, because the heart comes out when the mind goes in abeyance. When the heart comes out, it becomes more sensitive, becomes more effective, and therefore deeply touched, deeply moved by the pain and sorrow of the world. And what accompanies that journey to what is seen, just what is seen? A greater sense of aliveness. Because when the world is formed by our concepts, by our abstraction, the relationships are impermeable, concrete, distinct objects, like bumper cars, bumping into one another, but having no true relationship. And that's why, at the level of relationship, two human beings I'm speaking of now, when we have known each other for a long period of time and there's a whole history, it works against us and for us. How it works against us is that the person is now known and unable to be unknown, because we have frozen the person with our memories, and therefore there is a certain way in which dialogue is no longer possible, true dialogue. And how it works for us is that there can be a growing sense of safety with that person, so that one's heart can then speak the truth and then engage in true dialogue once more. But mostly it plays it safe and relates from the distinct knowing. And yet our heart craves intimacy. Why does it crave intimacy? Because intimacy is the absence of that knowing. It's the willingness to meet someone in a genuine and genuinely being affected, which means it's heart to heart, which means it's vulnerability to vulnerability, which means it's not conceptual overlay, it's not concept meeting concept, it's the willing to release ourselves from the hold of that concept and to join in that moment and truly be affected. That's what it means. And so the safety of a prolonged relationship can induce that intimacy, because safety is essential. Do we see why Sangha, the safety is essential? Because if it's not there, who's going to come out? Not this guy. Why would I come out? To be berated? To be judged? To be conceptualized? To be abstracted? I do that to myself. I don't need you. But if there's safety where there is the beginning, not the completion, because none of us are complete. We're all beginning to allow that non-judgmental spirit where I can show myself a little bit here. And maybe there will be some judgment, but it won't be the ridicule I face in the general populace. And so we're in dyads. And so we're bringing home the power of the Sangha in the rawness and the courage it takes. Okay, who are you in this moment when you bring nothing to it? God knows who I am. And you can see the battle line is clearly drawn between me as a person knowing who I am and the access to my heart, which is on the other side of that knowing. And I'm loath to go there because my fear tells me if I cross that boundary, fill in the blank, because we do. So we would rather stay on the safe side and live from insanity. Live with insanity. Insanity. Incredible. I have to read you something that shows you. You don't really need to know, have examples of insanity, but I'll give you one anyway. This is, one of you sent me this in an email, which I appreciate. It's called The Lawsuit of the Year. And it's true. The estate of avant-garde composer John Cage, who died 10 years ago, is suing musician Mike Batt for copyright infringement, claiming that the minute-long track of Silence on Batt's new CD sounds suspiciously like the 4-minute block of Silence in one of Cage's works. However, Batt defends his right to remain silent. He told the London Independent, "My silence is original silence, not a quotation from his silence." We need things like that. You see why the word connection has such an overriding authenticity to it. That we can ride that word forever into our hearts. Because the whole thing is about that. What happened to those retreatants after their 2 or 3 days of retreating is that they were more connected. They were with themselves. Each incident, each event, each experience internally was not an abrasive, God-fearing, "Oh my Lord, what's going on in me?" experience. But the normal flow of events, which when seen, which when addressed, which when made connect, when connected with, are nothing special. Even the most extreme rage or the lowest low, given the right context, given the right conditions, all of our minds contain the continuum of all minds. Let us be very clear about that. Your content may be different. Your readiness towards rage may be less because the conditions haven't been. But there is that quality in each one of us. Given the right conditions, this will arise. And when we see that, when we see that we contain all minds in our mind, great humility comes in it. There's nothing special about any of us. And when we can see that it's the passing of humankind in front of us, then who's going to take that person? In fact, there's a warming affection for even having it.
Because, okay.
Because in some ways, you know the shape and the conditions of your fellow human beings by sitting down and looking at yourself. And there's a warming that comes to that. Not a pretension. We're past that now. The great humility of heart. In which the pain of events still, in which we are still holding and making something out of it, making more out of it than what it, the pain of that is felt in oneself and it's felt externally in others, and the heart responds to that. It feels. There's no way to do this without feeling, without being affected. In fact, the proportionality of the opening of our heart is directly proportional to our being affected by the sorrows of what it's opening to. It's a two-way street. Open up and perceive. The other comes in. In New York City a few weeks ago. It was in August. And I could feel the continued rage of the previous year's events. And I could also feel the vulnerability from that rage. And I could feel how some people of consciousness were trying to stay within the vulnerability and not cover it with reactivity. But that's all of our dilemma. Because when we feel threatened, we go back into conceptualization, because that's the safety barrier that we all know. And with conceptualization, then we make problems out of things. We make, because our ignorance is the only thing that can speak through conceptualization, not our heart, not genuine contact, not genuine relationship. So the only relationship we can have through the mind is one in which we hold the other and other based in our ignorance. And it's from both sides. It's from the terrorists and it's from the terroristists. Each of us have a model of the other that is untrue, has no basis in the reality of the heart, but is so strongly believed that we will kill one another to protect ourselves from the perceived threat of the other. And that's the history of humankind. In the scene, there is just what is seen. So the Buddha is saying, Bahia, don't make a lot of this. Don't make a problem of your spiritual life. exchange, the essence is so simple, it's so available, that you add anything to what's there is too much. Anything to what's there is too much. Stand on your head, do pranayama, chant this, sing to that, praises of that. In their appropriate time and space, but when we're very close, we don't add a single chanting word. We don't add a single concept overlay. We just open. I have no idea who I am when I bring nothing to the moment. And in that rawness, in the innocence of that, because it's the essence of innocence. Because if I have anything other than innocence, I'm bringing something to the moment. If I bring anything, any role, any disposition, any interrogation, anything, sophistication, it's to protect me from that. And that's what we're protecting ourselves from. We're protecting ourselves from not being defined. But what we're really protecting ourselves from is a deep belief in our insufficiency. Because if we're not defined, then it proves that we're insufficient and that we never were any good. See, I don't have anything to offer. Well. This proves it. Do you know the answer to the question now? It proves you're a jerk. So we have to be willing to bring the fear of our insufficiency front and center. So that's what I'm bringing to the moment, my fear of insufficiency, that's what I'm bringing. Okay, hold it. Hold it. Don't look away. Don't allow it to operate behind the scenes making you something. Just hold it. Because the common denominator, of everything that is held and seen is zero. Because in the seen there's just what is seen. And therefore everything you bring on top of that can add really nothing to the moment beyond what is rightfully and truly there. What is rightfully and truly there. It's just the illusion, the abstraction, the imagination that's pretending that the moment is some other way and that I am some other way within the moment that I keep bringing forth. But it's like throwing paint into the air. Nothing is colored. Not having anything. My inadequate. Okay. Inadequate. What happens to it when I look at it? What happens to this sense of inward poverty when I actually own it? Be accountable. Nothing. It doesn't do anything. It doesn't confirm or... The worst thing is that I feel that you think something of me. But we're providing a container of safety so that I have less I'm less convinced that you're thinking something of me as the Sangha begins to grow in intelligence and in wisdom. So I'm beginning to rise even above that fear, which is an enormous fear. See how if we all come together in this thing, this is, we're in lockstep because we're our own worst enemies. I mean, we're each other's worst enemies. Because a flinch from you, a grimace from you, convinces me that I'm the insufficient person I feel I am. And you, all you have to do is nod or wink or do something which convinces me that you have seen that truth in me and I'm exposed. Oh God. Right? I'm not coming out again. You've nailed me. Now I've got to pretend I'm... Next time you see me, I won't be that way. I'll guarantee you that. I'll be more sophisticated, more something. Whatever I think you want from me, that's what I'll be. And then we'll take copyright out on our silence. Because that's the next step. It's just this far from what we do. Sometimes the insanity. Okay. So I didn't bring the talk to her. Because I wanted to, as the retreat runs in me, I wanted that exposure of myself. It's not so terrible, really. It's a little weird, and I don't know what you're thinking, but that's okay. All that was just what I was bringing. That was interesting. So then what you do is you just keep going, okay? You just keep going. Because there's a knowing in each of us to know whether it's authentic or not. And if it's authentic, then that's the barometer, that's the compass. It's not what people are thinking about what he's really, really well. No, it's, the barometer is the authenticity. So, and each of us know that. So we just keep moving towards true north. And true north says another layer. What about that layer? What about that layer that's right behind that layer? What about that one that's right there? What about the next? And so out it comes. So now my insufficiency is exposed. So then what? Well, then there's this rawness that eats at my heart, and that's the rawness of being ill-defined without my insufficiency. If I give you that, I have nothing back or skin. And then the terror of terrors. Is the stillness that lies behind the nobody, the unformed. And so I am found. I touch that stillness because now experience is seen as zero. As experience is seen as the common denominator of nothing. And when experience is seen as, it doesn't matter what the experience is. When it's seen like that, we see through experience. Because it no longer stops us. It no longer reflects or deflects our gaze. We're no longer trying to change the experience to fit a more comfortable experience. We see through the experience. Then we know. Then we sit there and meditate.